Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 36, and today I'm joined by Mark Schiffman, assistant professor in the Department of Humanities at Villanova University. He received his BA from St. John's College and his MA and PhD from the University of Chicago. He's written on St. Augustine and Ralph Ellison, and I'm very excited to know that his new translation of the De Anima is Aristotle's De Anima is due out in the fall. And he's written extensively on Plutarch, which is really what brings him to the digital dialogue today. I met Mark at this year's Ancient Philosophy Society meeting at Michigan State, where he delivered an excellent paper entitled Plutarch's Epsilon at Delphi, Eros, Phronesis, and the Lost Horizon of the Polis, in which he considers a text in which Plutarch is caught by his sons in front of some visiting foreigners and pressed to talk about the meaning of the enigmatic giant wooden Epsilon that stands at Delphi. Mark has also recently published an article entitled Erotic Wisdom and the Socratic Vocation in Plutarch's Platonic Question 1, which has just appeared in the Greek, Roman, and Byzantine Studies Journal, available online, and we'll link to that on the blog post. And that article will be the focus of our discussion today. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Mark to the Digital Dialogue.
Thank you, Chris. It's really a pleasure to have another chance to chat with you for a bit, and especially about some of the work that I'm doing currently.
Exactly. Well, I thought that was really excellent to meet you at the Ancient Philosophy Society, also to find out that you don't live very far from the house in which I grew up. So that was a kind of serendipitous thing to learn. And there must be something in the air there, because we're both drawn to some of the similar themes in Socrates. So maybe you could begin by talking a little bit about this essay on erotic wisdom, and also say a few words maybe about Plutarch himself.
Sure. So yes, I'll give some kind of broad background, and then and I'll give a very brief sketch of the article. And and since this is a dialogue, of course you should feel free to interrupt me at any point with questions or comments, as giving this what otherwise will be a monologue. So Plutarch is of course most well known for his lives as biographies of great Greek and Roman statesmen. But he's also probably the most important Platonist of the late first and early second centuries, and also probably the classical author from whom we have the largest body of texts. There are 11 volumes in the Loeb series of the Lives, and then 15 volumes of the Moralia, which is just a collective name for everything other than the Lives that Plutarch wrote. And on top of that, there's a catalog, an ancient catalog of Plutarch's works that list, you know, the several that we no longer have. So he's a very prolific writer and important in the Platonic tradition. And unfortunately, you know, as with many of the other Greek authors, he really dropped out of the medieval European tradition, though he remained very important for the Byzantines. And therefore, when all of those texts migrated to Europe in the Renaissance, he was discovered in a big way, and was a very important author from then until at least the 19th century, and is probably the single most important figure for Montaigne as a philosopher, as a philosophical model, and in certain ways a literary model as well. And so, so in a way, Plutarch has a central role in the rebirth of skepticism in modern philosophy. Mm-hmm. And so, this kind of raises questions what kind of Platonist Plutarch himself is, and especially how he understands Socratic skepticism as a part of the Platonic tradition. So that's one of the things that I'm particularly interested in trying to work out. And there's kind of a standard view of that in Plutarch's scholarship these days, which is that that he's sort of a doctrinal Platonist who uses skeptical strategies in his polemics against the Stoics and the Epicureans, especially. Mm-hmm. Whereas what I want to argue is that, two things, really. One, that skepticism is a more dominant current in his thought, and that his the sort of elements of what we would call Platonic doctrine that he deploys in different works has to be understood in that light. And also that he, within the skeptical tradition, has a very distinctive, different way of understanding what skepticism is all about, and that is in terms of the centrality of Eros, which is what I ultimately treat in this essay.
Right.
And so picking up on the fact that that in the Platonic dialogues, Socrates says at different points that there are two things that he knows. One is he knows his ignorance,
right.
And this, of course, is what the earlier skeptical tradition emphasizes, but also that he understands erotics.
Right.
And I see Plutarch as seeing these two things as, in a certain sense, ultimately equivalent to each other.
I wonder how, in that regard, you see the two strains of what you've just outlined relating to one another, namely an attention to the practice of what Socrates is doing, and that having a priority in a certain sense over anything doctrinal, and also the role of Eros, and what Eros might mean in that context.
Well, yes, Eros. Well, if you think of Eros as, in some sense, equivalent to knowledge of ignorance,
mm-hmm.
One of the things that Plutarch emphasizes throughout this examination of the example of Socrates, even before he gets to explicitly to talking about to Eros and erotic wisdom, is in a way the difficulty of maintaining a kind of integrity as a philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the love of honor is of course a great impediment, and this was exploited by the Sophists as Plato portrays them.
Mm-hmm.
To sort of attach us to opinions that we think of as our own, and that we have some kind of investment in terms of our image and our own kind of psychological sense of our power as knowers.
Right.
So the way I see, first of all, in the Symposium in particular, it seems that one of the key features of how Socrates understands Eros there is in terms of our incompleteness,
mm-hmm.
in the way that we are incomplete both as knowers and also as mortal,
right.
beings, and how we then respond to that sense of incompleteness,
mm-hmm.
which usually. In most of the responses that we have to it is some kind of denial or covering it up,
right.
to ourselves.
Right.
So in that sense, the true wisdom concerning Eros, I think for Socrates, is a kind of honesty about our incompleteness,
right.
and learning to live wisely with that and with integrity. And that's so the connection to practice is that. That is an integrity that we're always in danger of losing.
Right. I guess maybe that's part of what I was trying to get at with the question of the relationship between doctrine and Eros, in the sense that when you speak about the human response to our incompleteness, one of those responses historically has been to posit doctrinal truth and then hold to them in a kind of dogmatic way.
Right.
And this is clearly something that, at least as you lay out in your essay, this is one part of the Socratic politics, the Socratic practice of philosophy, which is to have this kind of refutation of opinions that are held dear to the person holding them.
Right. Yes, that's sort of the most, in a way, Plutarch starts with that aspect of it, because that's, in a certain sense, the most public and the most obvious and evident beginning point for sort of awakening, one's interlocutors to this attachment to ideas, to arguments, to opinions. That that can be very strong and very passionate, but at the same time, bringing them to realize that it's really not well grounded.
Right. So I mean, but you also then say there's a second phase, right, or the second part or dimension of Socratic practice. Right?
What Plutarch does in this essay, if I go back to that,
mm-hmm.
just to give the brief
sketch,
and I think this will help clarify the terms of the discussion a bit.
Yeah.
So this is the first Platonic question, which is the Platonic questions are a set of 10 hermeneutical essays that look at specific passages in the Platonic dialogues and just basically ask what they mean.
Mm-hmm.
And this first one that I'm commenting on in the article examines the passage in Theaetetus at 150c, where Socrates describes his philosophical practice.
Mm-hmm.
And he describes it in terms of midwifery or meiosis in the Greek. So Plutarch opens by asking, why in the world did the god order Socrates to act as midwife to others, but forbid him to give birth himself? As the Theaetetus says, that's the opening of the question. And one quick point about that, Plutarch phrases it that the god ordered Socrates, which actually is not what the Theaetetus says. It says compel. Socrates says that the god compels him.
Mm-hmm.
And Plutarch's perfectly aware of this. This is one of the things that I trace in the article, the way that Plutarch offers a series of explanations of this passage, and the different explanations in a way lead to different, because they're partial and incomplete explanations, they lead to distortions of the words that Plato puts into Socrates' mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of through the interpretive process, Plutarch arrives finally at an explanation that does justice to every word in the original Platonic text. And I think this tells us something important about what it means to Plutarch to read Plato carefully, and we could talk more about that.
Yeah.
But so briefly, what then Plutarch goes on to do in the essay is to look at these different aspects of Socratic practice. So starting, as we mentioned, from this most obvious element, which is refutation.
Right.
The one that, got everyone angry at him and angry enough to put him on trial and execute him. And then arriving ultimately at the most internal and the most subtle aspect, which is the knowledge of erotics and the erotic wisdom that he talks about.
Mm-hmm.
And the first four aspects are all also key terms for understanding skepticism. Mm-hmm. So we start with the lenkos, or refutation, and that's the first aspect under which he tries to understand what Socrates is saying. Then he turns to aporia, puzzlement, or lack of answers of one's own that one lays claim to. And this is where it turns to a more internal discipline of the questioner, of the philosopher.
Right.
That this maintaining the sense of not being satisfied with one's own answers, or being ready to put them to question always.
Mm-hmm.
And then he looks at two different ways of understanding skepticism traditionally. One is ephexis, or withholding judgment,
mm-hmm.
right? The sort of discipline never putting your eggs into the basket of one answer,
right?
But always looking at the alternative and exploring the arguments on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fourth aspect is zetasis, or the search for truth, the sort of active search that's premised upon the supposition that it is possible to find some truth.
Right.
Though without letting go of all of these cautions about right. what that calls.
Well, and I wonder what part of this erotic wisdom mm-hmm. Is is at work animating the zetasis at the end, or that you or this active searching, and even in the context of of a certain kind of recognition of incompleteness. And in some ways, it seems that Eros has both of these things: is being drawn to that toward which one may have an incomplete, or would sort of necessarily, I think, has an incomplete grasp of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this is where Plutarch sees something very distinctive that has been missed by the way the skeptical tradition has been formulated up to this point. Because there, you know, just an aside, the century or so before Plutarch is the period in which the meaning of Platonism becomes very contested. Uh-huh. And there are several varieties. And there are, you know, some that are sort of more pushing in the Stoic direction. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of a less radical sort of skepticism that emphasizes zetasis and seeking, and then there's a more radical skepticism, the Pyrrhonian skepticism, that emphasizes withholding judgment. Mm-hmm. And I think what Plutarch is, one of the things that Plutarch is concerned about is that if you don't, even if you understand skepticism as zetetic, and you know are sort of taking as a working hypothesis that you can understand and find truth, if you don't understand it in terms of Socrates' erotic wisdom, then it is in danger of becoming a kind of doctrine or a kind of you know, kind of partisanship
right.
of a school rather than something with a rather than a sort of authentic life of philosophical inquiry.
Right. Right. I mean, do you see this time as a kind of the, I don't, maybe this is the beginnings of, but certainly an early stage of this longer history of Platonism? I mean, if we make a distinction between the Platonic text and Platonism, mm-hmm. Where, you know, now you're beginning to see these doctrines being systematized and being thought in terms of doctrines rather than as it seems Plutarch is trying to insist that they are their practices, and at least if your reading is right, and I'm very sympathetic with it, that really Socrates offers, as you say, a model of practice and not a doctrine.
Yes, I think that's right. I think both, you know, contemporary with Plutarch and certainly very much so after his time, you get a very doctrinal development that leads to, you know, what we call Middle Platonism, which is very theological, mm-hmm. And you know, sort of takes the Timaeus as a kind of a central guiding text, and then Neoplatonism with Plotinus and Porphyry.
I mean, is that where you see, in terms of a longer history of philosophy, is that where you see in Porphyry and Plotinus the doctrinaire position kind of winning out and establishing itself?
Yeah, you know, I'd be hesitant to say anything quite so strong as that about Plotinus, just because I haven't come back to Plotinus yet and
right.
And really looked at him carefully, but certainly I would say they certainly lay a foundation for a kind of a distinctly circumscribed tradition of Platonism. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, and I wonder, there may be a sort of deeper human story to tell about that, and going back to what I had mentioned earlier, namely as a kind of way of responding to incompleteness or to the somehow the recognition of incompleteness. Because we do have a tendency to hold on to things that are stable and to look to things that we hold as stable. And I think one of the ironies here is that Socrates is really, at least the way he's portrayed in the dialogues, is completely oriented against that and to undermining those stable things.
Right. Yeah, and I think, I mean, there are two things I'd say about that. One in terms of Plutarch, one of the elements of, you might say, of instability, or at least of sort of constant reorientation in Plutarch, is simply the fact that he writes in such a variety of genres and voices.
Mm-hmm.
So what's put forward as something that looks like a Platonic doctrine or a sort of theological answer to a particular problem that's being discussed will be in the mouth of some character or within a specific rhetorically crafted voice in a letter, for example.
Right.
And so as with the Platonic dialogues in Plutarch's writings, it's always important to pay attention to what the setting is, what the voice is, and what the kind of driving concerns are, who the characters are, all those sorts of things.
Right.
The other thing, well, you can go ahead on that
but remember that point, because I just wanted to maybe segue back into the whole question of Platonic writing, because it seems that Plutarch has more of a diversity of genres that he writes in, whereas Plato's writing was pretty consistently dialogical, except for maybe some letters that we have and things. So, I think there's something really important about the relationship between this, the skepticism and the need to or the desire to write in a diversity of genres, namely that one can the complexity of things is such that it requires getting at it from different perspectives, articulating it in different ways. And I'm wondering what you think about the relationship between Plutarch's skepticism and the decision really to write in these varying genres.
Yeah, well, I think that's it's a very intimate connection, because to go back to an earlier point that we were discussing, thinking about skepticism and philosophy as a practice, one place you see this is when you look at the lives themselves, because in the various lives, one of the things that Plutarch is trying to revive is an Aristotelian understanding of phrenesis, right, of mm-hmm. kind of practical wisdom in the sense of a kind of explicit understanding of the ends toward which one is directing oneself and the sort of relevant virtues involved and the relevant difficulties involved in pursuing those ends. And that's a virtue that is... I think Plutarch understands as centrally important in sort of monitoring this integrity of philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
So there are several texts that of the sort that Pierre Hadot is very interested in, of the kind of turn to the self and sort of advice about how to be watchful over oneself and one's soul.
Right.
So that's this is also, I think, a fairly distinctive and important aspect of how Plutarch understands his Platonism, that it involves an integration of this Aristotelian understanding of phrenesis.
Mm-hmm.
But in the lives, then, we see this virtue enacted and tested in various ways and running up against the limitations of different characters' passions and conceptions. So, for example, in the life of Cato the Younger, we see, you know, the effects of Cato's stoicism on his political decisions, and his, you know, his conception of what's possible and what's feasible. But also we see how his attraction to stoicism is linked to his character as a young man.
So, and then
in each life, we see this in a certain way from both from the perspective of the character being discussed, but also with, you know, sort of critical commentary, usually in suggestive ways by Plutarch himself. Mm-hmm. So this ability to really adopt these different angles and perspectives, and to embody them in different voices and different genres, I think is crucial to how Plutarch understands how we get perspective on ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's one of the ways in which there certainly is a strong resonance between what Plutarch's doing and the Platonic decision to write dialogues, is that you always have an embedded person embedded in a social situation, a context, and you don't have that sort of strict divorce between, let's say, the theoretical and the practical that sort of emerges later. And that sense of philosophy as an engaged activity is one that Plutarch seems to be, that seems to resonate with between Plutarch and what Plato seems to be doing with his writing.
Yes, I think that's right. And though there's a very funny contrast that this leads to, which is that in the Platonic dialogues, one of the ways that is manifested is that the voice of Plato himself is totally absent.
Right.
And you have the voice of Socrates or some other narrator, but you always have the voices of different characters. Whereas in a way, for exactly the same sorts of reasons, you have the opposite result in Plutarch. That is, that Plutarch very often injects his own voice into his writings. And I think that's partly a response to the concern about philosophy becoming too much of a sort of, you know, theoretical discourse, and the importance of placing oneself and, you know, one's own sort of existential involvement in a more prominent place within the within the voice of philosophical writing itself.
Right. I mean, that makes a really interesting point with regard to sort of the disjunction between Socrates on the one hand, who didn't write, and Plato on the other, who did write, but didn't write in his own voice. So whereas Plutarch has this writing in his own voice as well. So I mean, it does lead us maybe back to that question that we wanted to touch a little bit more upon, which was the question of Platonic writing and Plutarch's attitude toward it. I really liked in the essay how you drew out Plutarch's attention to the specific words in the text, according to use a modern scholar's vocabulary, Strauss's notion of logographic necessity, and say Plutarch was already operating according to it in a certain way.
Right. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. I think Plutarch recognizes that that Plato writes very carefully. And this is this not only in this first Platonic question, but I'm trying to do some work on the rest of them as well, and that's repeatedly the case, that that the very specific words matter a lot, and Plutarch gives different formulations of them that seem to correspond with different interpretations that he's trying out. Mm-hmm. There's a sense in which, you know, Plutarch, in a way, is signaling at the same time that that's how you have to read him.
Right.
that his word choices are always very deliberate and very very well considered and important as well.
Go ahead. The one thing that I wanted to ask really about is, so one of the things that I'm focusing on in some of my work and also with the podcast as well is sort of what are the virtues or the excellences of dialogue. And one of the things that as I was reading your essay struck me was that skepticism really is about a certain kind of openness or a certain way of being open to ambiguity and uncertainty and other kinds of things. And I wonder what you would say about that, first of all, and then what resources we have in Plutarch to sort of think a little bit more deeply about that virtue, if we can call openness a virtue, even though it wouldn't sort of been in the list of traditional virtues.
Right. Yeah, I think to come back to Montaigne for a minute, and sort of roundabout path back to Plutarch, but it connects with what we were just talking about, because there's very good reason to think that this model of the very personal voice of philosophy is one that Montaigne draws specifically from Plutarch.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very interesting remark that Montaigne makes about Plutarch in the Apology for Raymond Sebond, which is, of course, his defense of skepticism.
Right.
In the texts of that essay that are published, unfortunately, this passage usually doesn't appear. It was in a text that was published during Montaigne's lifetime. But then in the subsequent editions, it was dropped out. But it talks about Plutarch being sort of exemplary for having a form of writing that's doubtful and indeterminate.
Mm-hmm.
And he calls it an inquiring rather than an instructing style, even though it's interspersed with touches of the dogmatic form, he says. So Montaigne is very alert to this aspect of Plutarch's writing, and in certain ways it serves as a model for his own skeptical openness. And one of the things that Montaigne says in that essay, which I think is a good representation of Sir Plutarch's skeptical temper, is that he sort of sees the best version of skepticism as saying, well, we don't really know enough to know whether we know or don't know. and that I think is part of what Plutarch is getting at in his exploration of the erotic dimension, right? That the experience of this sort of erotic, compelling attraction to the divine and the intelligible, as he says,
mm-hmm.
is partly an experience of sort of, you know, having a sense of something, having a glimpse of something that's compelling as truth, but at the same time there's enough that it's elusive enough,
right,
that we can never really be confident of it as something that we have a grasp on.
Right. Well, I wonder how that relates. I mean, at the very end of the Platonic Questions text that you translated, we may be able to post that a link to that also. I don't know how you feel about that, but there's this gesture to this notion of awakening a thoughtfulness in the nature of those with whom Socrates speaks, and I'm wondering what the notion of thoughtfulness is in that context, because it has to involve obviously this erotic openness, which is, of course, the thoughtfulness has to, it can't be a kind of dogmatic, you know, embracing of something, but it really is this something that is awakened in us.
Yes. Part of it, I think, is simply, you know, an attentiveness to what is going on around us, you know, and what is, well, that disposition toward wonder, right? That Aristotle describes so well, and sort of maintaining that disposition in a sense about everything,
right?
And this again, this is reflected in the enormous variety of things that Plutarch, you know, sort of raises questions about in his different writings.
Well, I'm really interested in this strand from Plutarch to Montaigne, and then probably could extend that to someone like Emerson. And you have this whole sort of tradition of essay writing, of essaying, of trying, of testing in that sense. That you know, to trace that also back to what Socrates is doing, I think, is a really important strand to hold on to, particularly in a history of philosophy that often gets seen as a sort of system of doctrines that are sort of replaced one after the other, that there is still this this very practically oriented dimension, not only dimension of philosophy, but philosophy as a practically oriented activity. And the notion that a certain openness can emerge out of the attentiveness that you are talking about, that in fact, if we attend carefully enough to the complexity, to the curiosity and the wonder of things, that we will begin, I hope, to learn a kind of openness and resist the temptation to close things off and to grab on to the doctrine or to hold dogmatically to certain kinds of ideas just because they make us feel more comfortable or less uncertain.
Right. Yeah, I think you know, as you I'm sure noticed in my discussion of the erotic wisdom section of the article, you know, I sort of appealed kind of in tandem to the specific text of Plutarch and other texts of his that are related to it, but also to just the experience of sort of, you know, erotic awakening to the intelligible as such, right?
Right.
And I think it's, you know, I think one of the temptations to, you know, to sort of talk about for a moment about the practice of being a scholar of philosophy.
Right.
One of the, you know, it's a very strong temptation to try to fit Plutarch into a narrative that, you know, we can sort of already make some sense of in terms of the development of Platonism in this time, but also to try to see, you know, try to sort of sort out what is the doctrinal system within Plutarch. Because, you know, if you approach Plutarch from this more sort of skeptical erotic angle that I'm trying to sort of bring forward, it's just really bewildering. I mean, you have to be constantly sort of losing yourself in his text and writing process, while at the same time, you know, reminding yourself of how these things look to you. In life,
right,
and you have to make those things work and live together. And in a way, that I think is, you know, even though you know, scholars will often tend to want to sort of, you know, have something that they can put into place and put forward and say, here's the system.
Right.
I think for most other readers who enjoy Plutarch, the way that he writes, the way that he raises these questions, really has a tendency to reinforce this constant, you know, attentiveness to variety of phenomena in the world and the variety of ways that we can explain and understand them.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. It's something that I think is sometimes missed for people who aren't involved in reading these texts in the way that we try to, where you really are allowing yourself to be perplexed about why this word and why not that word, and how, what this formulation and why this genre and not another genre. And I think certainly it's been one of the things in my reading of Aristotle that sort of was liberating. Once I stopped reading Aristotle as I had been taught in many classes early in my career, sort of as a systematic philosopher, and everything already worked out, but rather paying attention to his the constant metaphor in his writing, which is, I think, exactly what Plutarch recognizes as a consistency between Plato and Aristotle, namely that there's this, it's a kind of path, it's a kind of the path of thinking and the aporetic nature of thinking and the process of thinking. And once you begin to read Aristotle, I think once you begin to read Plato and I guess Plutarch too, in that way, then there's, even though there's this sort of frustration of trying to delineate exactly what the dogmatic position is you become kind of liberated to really follow along with the thinkers and learn something not only about what they had to teach, but also what the nature of human life itself is.
Yeah, that's right. I have exactly the same experience with Aristotle, though it was more a matter of my coming to him with an assumption that a philosopher, you know, should have a dogmatic system of some kind, because certainly that was not. That was not the vision.
Certainly not at St. John's, I'm sure.
St. John's, no. but nonetheless, you know, it takes some real learning to learn how to read Aristotle that way, and to see, you know, that there are subtleties. There's even actually humor. That you otherwise would miss.
Exactly. Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because every time I say that, people think, you've been reading Aristotle for too long, you're crazy. But I really appreciate you coming on to the Digital Dialogue to talk about these things with me, and I'm looking forward to maybe we could have another session on the De Anima when it comes out.
Oh, that would be great.
Thanks, Mark.
Well, thank you very much, Chris.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You'll find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.